This is Michelle Schacht, and you're listening to radio, powered by the people, KPFK. 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Well, good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of The Lawyer's Guild. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host and dear friend Maria Hall, and we do welcome you and are glad you've joined us today. Maria, let our listeners know what we're going to be covering today.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Well, today we'll continue our critical analysis of recent court decisions, especially focused on the efforts by the Trump administration to erode the checks and balances within the U.S. government that are meant to protect individual liberties from the abuse of government power. So on today's show, we'll be looking into recent decisions concerning federal worker unions, racial profiling of immigrants, expedited deportations, tariffs, and more.
Well, that sounds like a full hour for sure. This is, of course, also the end of our summer fun drive, so we want to remind our listeners to be mindful of that as we continue with this program. We do this every couple of weeks at least. We bring these cases, of which there are so many, to our listeners. It's an analysis I don't think you receive anywhere else. I can't think of where else on the airwaves you might be receiving it. We think it's critically important, and many of the listeners have shared us with us the fact that they agree with us on that. So do consider giving us a call at 818-985-5735 or simply going to our website at kpfk.org. Choose among the many ways we have of saying thank you when you support this station. As Maria and I like to say, we hope our show and all the other wonderful shows on this station are thanks enough, but we thank you doubly by sending you a premium, a gift of whatever sort you may pick, depending on the size of your contribution. And we do urge you to do that as we get started. Prove to us that you can make the call, listen to the show all at once. Yes. I know it may sound like a tall order, but it can be done. But let's get right into the topic today. We've got a lot to cover.
Yes. All right, Jim, did you...
No, I just wondered if you were going to ask that the first question.
I will do. I wanted to introduce our renowned friend, Steve Brody. Our guest, of course, on this subject is our resident constitutional law expert, Stephen Rohde, scholar, writer, lecturer, political activist, and community leader who did practice civil rights and liberties law for over 50 years. He now enjoys his retirement by working 24/7 on these issues. He's the past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California and past national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for peace. As well as a founder and chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. He's also most recently special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council, and also the host of a new podcast called Speaking Freely, produced by Ms. Studios. Of course, Mr. Rohde is speaking only for himself today. Welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show, Stephen Rohde.
What a pleasure it is to be with you, Maria, and with Jim today.
Great. Well, our first topic concerns the union protections for federal workers, something we've talked about on the show several times, and specifically Trump's March 27th, 2025 executive order that aimed to restrict the collective bargaining rights for over a million federal workers. The executive order has been challenged in court, and there was an interesting update this week. Yeah, interesting, that we want to hear about. But first, give us the lowdown. Who brought the case challenging this executive order, and on what grounds?
Yes, interesting as in a terrible setback. That is the March 27 executive order. Perhaps no order, although it's hard to prioritize Trump's executive orders in their cruelty and impact on the American people. But this one may affect a million employees at the federal government. What Trump did is he took away the collective bargaining rights of a whole range of agencies in the federal government under the pretext that they were, their primary function was intelligence, counterintelligence, national security, the highest level of concern that the president could cite. So the American Federation of Government Employees, the National Association of Government Employees, the AFL-CIO, and other plaintiffs representing those million workers filed suit on April 7, just within days of his executive order. They challenged his finding in the executive order that there was a national security risk if agencies such as the Environmental Protection Agency, parts of the Department of Treasury, Energy, Agriculture, Interior, Health and Human Services, and Social Security Administration, that there was a national security risk if collective bargaining was conducted by the federal employees of those agencies. Now, he also cited the State Department and other federal agencies that might have some connection to foreign intelligence and national security. But the ones I listed didn't. The lawyers and the plaintiffs in that case went to court to challenge that case.
Uh-huh. And there was an appeal in the case, was there not? That was just decided this week, in fact. What was the appeal about? And well, what was the appellate court's decision?
Well, the appeal was taken from another comprehensive decision. In that case, on June 24, a federal judge granted a preliminary injunction, finding specifically that all of these executive orders, these cutbacks on collective bargaining, were simply punishment of the unions for having criticized the Trump administration and even having filed previous lawsuits and other connections. So the district court, in a very comprehensive opinion, found that it was the hostility to the unions that was the real motive for denying them collective bargaining rights, not this cooked-up reason of national security. Uh-huh. It was a solid opinion, but unfortunately, on August 1st, just a few days ago, three judges of the Ninth Circuit stayed that preliminary injunction, meaning that Trump's executive order can go forward denying all of those employees their collective bargaining rights. Now, I think it's worth a few minutes to think about this decision. The Ninth Circuit has a reputation for being a very liberal circuit, which I analyze as being a circuit that actually follows the Constitution rather than ignoring it. But randomly selected, this appeal drew two Trump judges, Bridget Bade and Daniel Bress, and a Obama appointee, John Owens. Now, this is only the question of a stay. As I've said till I'm blue in the face on this show and elsewhere, the status quo was collective bargaining across all of these agencies. Trump disrupted the status quo by issuing his executive order. All that the lower courts did was to maintain the status quo, which is what injunctions are about. But these three Ninth Circuit judges have stayed the injunction. Now, I've analyzed this case. One of the grounds is a likelihood of success. They claim there is a likelihood of success, giving great deference to the president to decide national security issues. But a critical element for a stay is irreparable injury. And as the court pointed out, And I think this is exactly why an Obama judge joined in this opinion. John Owen saw the writing on the wall. Two Trump judges could have granted this stay by themselves. But my reading of the tea leaves is that Judge Owens joined and pointed out that immediately after that lawsuit was filed, the next day, the federal government said they would take no action to decertify any bargaining unit until the, quote, conclusion of litigation. So they essentially tied their own hands. And I think by pointing that out, Judge Owens is hoping that the federal government will keep their word. And but frankly, there can't be irreparable injury if they already said they were not going to decertify. Now, finally, I think this is a case, and this may go to your next question, that they have their eye on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has been staying these injunctions. And I think the lower courts are taking a pounding, and the Supreme Court is admonishing them to grant these stays, even though they're not well taken.
Well, and in fact, let me just slip this in here to underline the point you just made. There was just a report in the New York Times of a day or so ago that indicated that whereas the lower federal courts all across the country taken their decisions altogether, over 90% of them were contrary to what Trump was seeking to do. Over 90% of them, 93 point something. On the other hand, it pointed out that the U.S. Supreme Court was just the reverse of that. Over 90% supporting whatever the hell Trump was going to do. That's a rather shocking figure, isn't it?
It is, and it's under that shadow docket, the emergency docket. They don't get to the merits. They don't issue opinions, they don't explain themselves, but they've got the power of six votes. Yeah. And it's shameful, but it's the power we're facing. And I'm proud of these lower courts for continuing to fight back.
Mm-hmm. And slowing everything down a bit. But in a press release on Monday, the American Federation of Government Employees, one of the largest unions of federal workers, they vowed to keep fighting in spite of this ruling. But what would victory look like in this case, in your eyes? And how long might it take to get there? You had mentioned the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that where it's inevitably heading, do you think?
Yes. I mean, I don't think they'll get a favorable reading. Now, all the Supreme Court has to do is ratify what the two Trump judges did and the third judge in the Ninth Circuit of all places. So at that level, I think this stay will remain in effect. I think what the American Federation of Government Employees and the other plaintiffs mean is they are in this fight for the long haul. They have adduced evidence. They have shown retaliatory action by the Trump administration. These large organizations, they have the wherewithal. Thank goodness unions have their membership. They have membership dues. They are able to fight these fights. And this one, I think they're going to fight on the merits as long as they can.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right, continuing right along then if we can on that. Let's turn to another Ninth Circuit Court decision. This one concerns immigration and those roving ICE patrols that have invaded the Los Angeles region and did so much of that in June and July. The court put a stop to these masked men driving around snatching people off the street, apparently just because of what they looked like. Steve, who brought this case and what were their legal claims?
Well, this was brought by a group of organizations and individuals. It was brought by three men who have been courageous enough to name themselves as plaintiffs in a federal lawsuit. They were wrapped up in these roving, indiscriminate raids that ICE has been conducting, particularly in Los Angeles, ever since June 6th, the horrendous day when they launched this onslaught. What is shocking is that two of those men are U.S. citizens, pointing out who gets wrapped up in these wholesale raids, plus other brave organizations that I always want to name, the L.A. Worker Center Network, the United Farm Workers, the Immigrant Defenders Law Center, all represented by the ACLU and other fine lawyers. So they brought their claim, and they were able to win a temporary restraining order in the U.S. District Court. Judge Mamie Awezi Mensa Frimpong, who completely analyzed exactly how ICE was going about these raids. She issued a 52-page decision on July 6. The issue is reasonable suspicion. It's lower than even probable cause, but even reasonable suspicion to seize and arrest someone believed to be in the United States illegally cannot be based solely on race, ethnicity, language, location, or employment. And what ICE is doing is they are going to the likely locations and job sites where Spanish speaking people work, and they are ignoring any other evidence and using race, ethnicity, language, location, and employment to be a stand-in for reasonable suspicion. Well, the U.S. District Judge saw through that, issued that injunction. Now, so used to getting stays of these injunctions, the Trump administration ran into the Ninth Circuit. And this shows you how important judicial selections matter, and the choice of the judges. Because in this case, the case was heard by Marsha Berzon, a Clinton appointee, Ronald Gould, a Clinton appointee, and Jennifer Song, a Biden appointee. And they denied the stay. They said no stay is required. The government has not proven a likelihood of success on the merits or irreparable injury. In fact, in a very clever holding, and now this is the appellate court, said if, as defendants, meaning the Trump administration, as the Trump administration suggests, they are not conducting stops that lack reasonable suspicion, they can hardly claim to be irreparably harmed by an injunction aimed at preventing a subset of stops not supported by reasonable suspicion. I thought that was such an effective turnaround on the government, which was claiming they weren't doing these dastardly things. Well, then, if we enjoin you from doing them, no harm, no foul. These cases are hard to prove under the Fourth Amendment, and it is the right of the people in the Fourth Amendment to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures. And you have to prove you've been harmed and that you're likely to be harmed again in the same way in the future. Excuse me. I want to point out that the Fourth Amendment speaks of people. A lot of people in America go around with the notion that it's only citizens who have rights under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. You don't see the word citizen used in the Bill of Rights in terms of who enjoys rights. You see people and persons, and everyone on the soil of the United States is entitled to these protections. That Ninth Circuit opinion scolded the Department of Justice for misreading the temporary restraining order, for mischaracterizing what the district judge had done. And they pointed out that defendants have failed to establish that they will be chilled from their enforcement efforts at all, let alone in a manner that constitutes the irreparable injury required to support a stay pending appeal. A preliminary injunction hearing is set in September. This case will go forward, but we've now gotten solid opinions from four different lower court judges based on the facts and the law And it's going to be very hard for the Supreme Court to deny that.
So, you'd mentioned, you know, basically what happens next. But also this morning, there's a big story because federal agents use Penske rented truck in immigration raid at Home Depot parking in Westlake, which is near Koreatown, if people don't know. An acting U.S. attorney, Bill Esaley, posted on X that the government would proceed with immigration raids. So do you think that that means that the federal government is sort of undeterred by these rulings?
Well, they better not be undeterred to the point of violating them, because although it is taking months in other courts, proceedings to hold lawyers and federal officials in contempt of court are underway. And in hearing these judges at the trial level and the appellate level, if these ICE agents even think of violating this order of not proceeding with legal reasonable suspicion of rounding up U.S. citizens, how much less reasonable suspicion can you have than if you actually seize a U.S. citizen? It means you're not checking the law, you're not checking the records, you are sweeping people up because of their race and ethnicity and the language they use. So it's a warning to these ICE agents that the law is coming for them and they had better abide by these rulings.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about another immigration case as well, though, where one of the tactics officials have been using to deport people quickly is by using an expedited removal process for people who are in the country for less than 2 years. But a federal judge just added some protections for new arrivals as well, didn't they? Tell us about this and what the implications may be.
Yes, this is still at the district court level, because I think we're trying to report on everything as it happens. So expedited removal is a tactic that is in the statute, but it has strict requirements. We're talking about a category of migrants who have come from designated countries, in this case, including Cuba and Venezuela, the two migrants specifically in this particular case. But it also can involve hundreds of thousands of others from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, because those countries have been found to be engaging in human rights violations, and these individuals are at risk for being returned to those countries. So, under existing law, which has not been overturned or repealed, they enter the U.S. at an official point of entry on humanitarian grounds to work temporarily in this country. And as you come and go in your daily lives in cities and towns, urban and rural, for all you know, some of the workers you see are protected under this program, which is called immigration parole. Well, once again, the Trump administration has attempted to circumvent the law by issuing fast-track deportations and expedited removals, which are skipping over the due process rights of these individuals. So in Washington, D.C., on August 1st, a few days ago, U.S. District Judge Jaya Cobb, a Biden appointee, blocked the federal immigration agencies from using two Trump administrative directives to get around the law. The judge found that the immigrants had played by the rules. And the judge says that the tactics of these plainclothes officers may look more and more like the countries from which they tried to escape. Judges are finding that what's being experienced here is exactly some of the lawlessness that people have been escaping from and coming to the United States with the hope and dream that they would be protected here under programs of this kind. There was previously a phone app program that has been discontinued by the Trump administration. This is in the Washington, D.C. Court system. There's no question that the government has their applications for emergency appeals on speed dial. I'm sure they will go to the appellate court first on this one. But the trial judge already denied a stay, saying that she was confident in her opinion and the grounds didn't exist to allow the Trump administration to fast track these removals, that they should follow the law. And if they can prove any grounds why these migrants have relinquished their status, then they could be removed lawfully, but not through this expedited removal. That's a hopeful sign. It's one of those 400 cases that have been brought, over 200 injunctions of this nature. But as Jim realistically points out, as much as justice is prevailing in the lower courts, the last 16 cases in a row, meaning they were favorable to the plaintiffs that reached the Supreme Court in one way or another, especially with this shadow docket, the Supreme Court has been giving the Trump administration this lawless zone to perpetuate what it's doing. And it really, it's not theoretical. It's not just for the dusty law books that we're concerned about this. It's because real lives are being damaged in the interim, and the status quo of those lives is being disrupted, and that's why we're grateful for the lawyers and these lower court judges for doing what they're doing.
Well, Steve, we have just a couple minutes before the break, and you know it is fun drive time. I just wanted to throw a question out to you spontaneously because I know this radio station is so important to you. What would be your reason, your top one or two reasons why people should give? And it really doesn't matter how much you give. It really is the feeling that we are all in this together and we have to show truth. We have to let the airwaves go. So please tell us that and then we'll break for a quick station ID and then we'll be back with more questions.
It's a wonderful and good question. I have supported personally KPFK for so many years. I have ensured that organizations I'm part of become regular monthly contributors to KPFK. I would hazard with due modesty to suggest that people are not hearing the kind of analysis on this show of the legal efforts the Trump administration is making to destroy democracy and the strenuous, brave efforts of lawyers and judges to fight back. I've said here that these legal actions are necessary, but they are not sufficient, meaning that all of the activism that we engage in must continue even as we follow the legal track. But it's at KPFK that you hear in-depth analysis of these cases and also the activism and the broad issues that are discussed. I personally, without any shame, believe that KPFK is indispensable to the movement and the resistance that the United States is conducting to defend democracy.
Indeed, we're really the voice of the movement, aren't we, Steve? I mean, it doesn't have its own radio station the way corporate America has many radio stations, if you will. But KPFK is the only voice on the radio here that that speaks for the movement. Yes, Steve?
And just in the last few days, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has shut yes. down. So yes. all of those public stations are closing in rural areas, in urban areas, with all kinds of weather information, farm information, information to the health and livelihood, if not the culture and beauty of life that public radio provides. And in that sense, KPFK has insulated itself because it does not accept government money. It does. It depends on the generosity of listeners to be sure it will last through this, that Trump cannot threaten KPFK as much as he would like to. So that's why it's important that folks support this station.
Absolutely. Well, we will now break for a very brief station ID break. Don't go anywhere, folks. We'll be right back with you.
Support for KPFK comes in part from the Levitt Pavilion Los Angeles, presenting outdoor concerts starting Saturday, June 28th through August 30th in MacArthur Park. The mission of Levitt Pavilion Los Angeles is to make live music accessible to all, creating stronger and more connected communities while celebrating the diversity of our city and beyond. Further information is available at levittlosangeles.org. That's L-E-V-I-T-T losangeles.org and kpfk.org.
And we are right back with you, as promised. You're still listening to the Warriors Guild Show here on KPFK. I'm Zoom Lafferty, along with Maria Hall, my co-host. And as we do a couple of times a month, at least here on the show, something which we've been discussing is quite unique, we bring to you an analysis of what's going on in the courts, and the courts have seldom been busier than they are these days. We do that through having our resident constitutional law expert, Steve Rohde, and that's what we're doing today. And in a minute, we'll get on with some more of those cases. Who's up next, Maria? I can't remember if that's you or me.
Oh, by all means.
Go ahead. Well, sure. here's what I'm wondering about, I guess. Listeners can learn more about these cases, I take it. But before we get to that, I had a couple of questions. As I was listening to you talk, I was thinking about the fact that you've mentioned a couple of times today, the shadow docket. You've talked about that before. You've explained it before, but I think it bears explaining again. It is being used in quite a unique way during the Trump administration. And I wonder if, and we'll get to that, not to worry. But before we lose that thread, if you would talk to us a bit about what the shadow docket really is and why it is playing such havoc, or the role that and this lopsided difference between the Supreme Court and the lower courts.
Yes, I think it so bears understanding and analysis. Most people expect to hear a Supreme Court decision that has followed the filing of briefs, oral argument by the parties, the filing of a friend of the court briefs, amicus briefs. Then the justices are known to retire for weeks, if not months, to consider and think about their decisions, and then they issue lengthy opinions to explain the reasoning behind their analysis and their decision making, and then sometimes there will be dissents because of contrary views. The emergency docket, now it has a place in Supreme Court law. If there is a death penalty pending, and there are serious legal issues in that case that need a court to review them, you certainly don't want the defendant executed before the courts can hear the case. So that's why you would need a process for an emergency stay, literally stay of execution. And there are other rare cases, and these are very rare situations, because by definition, the Supreme Court is intervening in the midst of litigation before it has been fully briefed, sometimes before it's even gone to the intermediary appellate court to stay what the district court has found. And largely our district courts are fact-finding bodies. They're the judges that hear witnesses, testimony, declarations, evidence that they pore over. That's why there's discovery and depositions and all the rest that is heard in the trial court. And they issue findings of fact and conclusions of law. And in the normal process, that works its way up. And the public can have confidence that the ultimate decisions by the Supreme Court are factually based. You may disagree with them, but since they give their reasons, it encourages confidence in the court to at least see why they reached the results they did. But in the emergency docket, which a scholar a few years ago called the shadow docket, because it's all kind of done in the shadows, and I've taken to calling it the shameful docket, you don't get any of that. You mm-hmm. don't have full dress briefing. You don't have oral argument. You don't have amicus briefs. You don't have thoughtful consideration by the nine judges who, God willing, may consider what each of them has to say to each other. You and coming down to today, we are getting almost universally 6-3 decisions across purely Republican lines, meaning Republican on the 6 majority and the 3 democratically appointed brave women judges coming in dissent. It is only in the dissents that we find out what's really going on, because the majority don't write opinions on the emergency docket. In one case, they issued a 4-sentence ruling, which essentially said, we're doing this because we can. They simply announced they are staying the case, and that's the end of the discussion as far as they're concerned. It's a dangerous practice. It's unheard of to the extent to which the emergency docket's being used today. It's a companion to what Trump is doing. It is arming him at the highest court level. But to some extent, while we should be shocked, we shouldn't be surprised, because this is the very 6-3 majority that handed Donald Trump personal immunity from crimes committed during his official acts. And they are simply playing out this kind of super executive power. It's raw power to say, I'm going to sign with a Sharpie an executive order. It wipes away what Congress has done. It wipes away what the courts have done. And I'm doing it because I have the power to do it. And then to meet up with 6 reactionary judges doing his bidding. It's a very dangerous cocktail today. I don't know if we will come through this without, that's where we'll have irreparable harm to the court and the legal system. Yes. So it's important that people understand what's going on, because that's why we say no kings when we go into the streets to rally and protest. It is part and parcel of the resistance.
Indeed, indeed. And now that tariff matter,
Yes, that segues nicely into tariffs. Whew. Well, the tariffs are continuing to make headlines, both because of the potentially disastrous consequences to our economy, and also because Trump is being accused of overstepping his authority. And as a result, this one wasn't brought by the ACLU, by the way, but the government has been sued by businesses and a coalition of states over these tariffs. So who are these parties? Who are the ones challenging the tariffs in court? And what exactly do they want?
Yes, and it's so important that we're paying attention to this. It's another example, because you will see on CNN and even MSNBC and all the networks, constant talk about tariffs, 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 as if it's only a question of which country is going to be penalized. But they talk in terms of penalizing countries. I don't call these tariffs. I call them consumer sales taxes. Mm-hmm. Consumer sales taxes. It's the consumers that bear this cost. I don't think Donald Trump understands tariffs. I don't think he understood them in his last administration or in the last 6 months. He thinks he's imposing some kind of financial penalty on China and hundreds of other countries when he announces a tariff. He's imposing a consumer sales tax because those tariffs raise the price of goods, and that's passed on to you and me. Well, it turns out that in law, it's always whose ox is being gored. And in this case, it's the commercial sector. It's the business sector because they take the first hit. And so in this case, and these are actually a collection of cases, but in the primary case, five companies and 12 states got together and they filed a lawsuit claiming that the entire basis for, and I'll switch back and forth perhaps, calling them tariffs, that the entire basis is illegal. Now, can you imagine that the months we've spent on tariffs and that underlying it could be an unconstitutional, illegal act on the part of the Trump administration. And that's based on the following, which these lawsuits have raised. The Constitution says and only says that Congress shall have power to lay and collect duties to regulate commerce with foreign nations. It couldn't be more explicit. It's found in Article 1, because Article 1 is the people's article appointing Congress and the Senate. And it's there that the power to levy duties and regulate commerce with foreign countries resides. And all that the president's duty is to faithfully execute the laws of the country. That's his only duty. So there have been further statutes that enforced this congressional act. And one of them is the Emergency Economic Powers Act. And here the word emergency comes up again. And it's a dangerous word if you find it in our laws. Because dictators use emergencies. Authoritarians cook up emergencies in order to invoke special powers. And that's exactly what Trump has done here. And that's why these plaintiffs sued. They sued because to cook up an emergency, listen to this, Trump is saying, we have an emergency sufficient to impose consumer sales taxes on foreign countries because of opioids and fentanyl entering our country. That's one of his emergencies. And his only other emergency is that America is suffering a trade deficit. Well, in various ways, at various times, under various presidents for decades, presidents have complained about a trade deficit. That is hardly an emergency when it has existed for decades. It is addressed by various economic policies, but not to call it today an emergency that arose on January 20. Mm-hmm. And that's all he's, the only power he has, because he's facing a constitutional declaration that Congress controls tariffs, and they haven't passed any of these consumer sales taxes. So the plaintiffs that we mentioned, they went into two different courts to challenge this in five different lawsuits. Now, one of them is a court that doesn't get a lot of attention. It's the U.S. Court of International Trade. We have such a court. And it is made up of Article 3, meaning the same types of federal judges that hear other types of cases. Well, on May 28, three of those judges, again, randomly appointed, but listen to these judges. There was Gary Kurtzman, who was appointed by Obama, but there was also Judge Timothy Reif, appointed by Trump, and Judge Jane Restaney, appointed by Reagan. You have two Republican judges. This is a court of special competence. These are judges that deal only in international trade. They are not the busy judges that have to handle a whole range of cases. And these judges issued a lengthy opinion finding that Trump was violating the Constitution and the Emergency Economic Powers Act. Two Republicans, one appointed by Trump, find Trump is violating the law. In a separate case, only days later, an Obama judge in the U.S. District Court for the D.C. Circuit issued a 33-page opinion, essentially finding the same thing. And he decided he didn't have to transfer this case to the Court of International Trade. This is Judge Rudolph Contreras, that he could decide this case on the merits because it was so plain. By the way, for a period of time, Judge Contreras served on the FISA court, the Federal Intelligence Security Court, and he was appointed from 2016 to 2023 by Chief Justice John Roberts. So that's the opinion that John Roberts has of this judge, who likewise found that Trump is violating the Emergency Economic Powers Act and the Constitution itself. And that is where the case stood on its way to appeal.
Well, why don't you go ahead, Maria, and ask your next question, if you would.
Sure, sure. Well, I just wanted to know, what would a Trump win or a defeat look like?
Well, this is catastrophic. I mean, in the economic area, we generally deal with civil liberties, the personal liberties of individuals, migrants, the teachers, the students who are protesting. This would be a blunderbust to the Trump administration. If we woke up one morning and found that his entire tariff consumer sales tax was illegal and unconstitutional. So on July 31st, only a few days ago, there was a rare oral argument in the DC Circuit. They had combined all these five cases. They were all the same issue. 11 judges of the DC Circuit listened to oral argument on July 31st. Now they're continuing. It's a multi-day argument stretched over a week or so. But the reports are that that court and many of those members were highly skeptical of what the Trump administration was doing. They echoed the same kinds of concerns, and they cited the thoughtful opinions of the Court of International Trade and the District Court. That's now four lower court judges, and now these 11 judges that are looking at that. They are deeply concerned that it also may have violated the Administrative Procedures Act. No president has ever invoked an emergency of this kind in the history of our country or these laws. So again, we're reading a little tea leaves. Skepticism is helpful in an oral argument, but three lawyers here and others listening, we've seen skepticism and oral argument turn around. So I'm urging our audience to watch for the tariffs case, as I'm sure it will be reported in the news, and whether this throws Trump's dream of tariffs into a nightmare.
Yeah. And where, Steve, before we do run out of time, can our listeners learn more about your work and these cases and the kind of discussions we've been having here?
Yes, I am available online where I publish. which includes the Truth Dig, the LA Progressive. I'm very proud of my new podcast, Speaking Freely. Of course, here, and we should give a shout out to our colleagues at Law and Disorder Radio, heard every Monday throughout the week, streaming and on 20 radio stations as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's all we can do because we have some business transactions. Or do you have something else, Maria, you want to get into? I'm sorry, I can't hear you, Maria. You've somehow silenced yourself.
Sorry. Yes. No, I did just want to get the one last question in about a couple of the Supreme Court cases that I know you feel were wrongly decided, and we haven't had time to go into those. So if you could briefly just key us in on those cases.
Yes. And I may ask that we take a session because the Supreme Court finished its term, although mm-hmm. they're still doing a lot of mischief, even though the official term has ended. But there were cases, unfortunately, in which the court upheld a Tennessee law that banned the provision of hormones and puberty-blocking medication to minors prescribed to enable them to identify with and live their lives with the identity that they chose. There was a free speech case involving online pornography where they reduced the viewing public to that of children. And there was a case where they went in favor of parents taking their kids out of classrooms because books were being taught where they could learn about LGBTQ lifestyles and other kinds of families in America today. In each of those cases, the Supreme Court 6-3 distorted the legal standards that are used. It's a technical area, but the Supreme Court is using technical reasons. Under settled law, the Tennessee law blocking gender specification would have been struck down. The internet law would have been struck down because of First Amendment principles. Following previous precedent of the parents, the school district said that the mere exposure to different lifestyles, different races, different beliefs is part of what a public education is all about. So we highlighted them today briefly only to give you a sense that this Supreme Court is doing a lot of mischief even far and beyond the Trump cases as they're becoming known. And it's why the Supreme Court matters, and it's why the presidents we elect with future appointments to the court matter. And it's why all the kind of organizing and resistance we're going through now, the midterm elections and the elections in 2028 are going to matter so much to the kinds of justice issues we talk about on this program.
Yes. And thank you so much, Steve Rohde, for joining us again today to talk about those very issues and to talk about them in a way that our listeners can understand and can grasp the importance of and take that into consideration when they're in voting booths and as they're going about their lives. We do have some business we do have to transact. As we know, we always hate to take time out from our substantive discussions to do it, but if we didn't, we wouldn't have substantive discussions because we wouldn't have our radio.
And yes. It is a substantive discussion.
Well, it is,
because we're people power, and we don't have to wait for the government to give us the airwaves. We'll just take it.
Yeah.
That's what KPFK does. We just take the airwaves, but we need your help, listeners.
Yeah. As I said earlier, when Steve was making a very kind pitch, if you will, for you to give us a call. And by the way, our number now to give us a call at is 818-985-5735. Or just go to the website, kpfk.org. That way you can see what for $50, for $75, for $100, the ways in which we thank you. Although, as we say, we hope to think and think that our program is and maybe should be thanks enough, but we go beyond that. So important are you. And as I said earlier, we are really the voice of the movement in Los Angeles. It has no other voice like ours. It doesn't have corporate media, there's literally over 1,000 stations on that the corporate media has at its disposal. Pacifica Network and its stations around the country are really a minor group of stations by comparison number-wise. So that should be reason enough. When you give to us, you're supporting all of the various humanistic and liberal and progressive causes that we know so many of our listeners support. When we have those folks on the air from the various movements around town, they report back to us. It helps them get people at their rallies, at their membership meetings, doing, engaging in the kind of work. So when you give to the station, you not only ensure that this rather singular voice for the progressive movement in LA will remain on the air, but you help it do what that voice can do, and that is bring more success, more power, more persuasive work from that community. But Maria, there are a few ways this at the moment we're thanking people in particular. I think it's worth mentioning. Could you mention those, please?
Absolutely. You know me, I'm always a fan of music. And yes, so KPFK, and go to the website, you'll see so many books and CDs and everything. But the one that really caught my eye was Peggy Lee's Greatest Hits, and it's 74 songs by Peggy Lee. And it's basically the songbook, you know, the jazz standard big band songbook. That's for a $100 donation. KPFK will send you that thank you gift, Peggy Lee's Greatest 74 songs. There's also Brenda Lee for $100 as well, and Little Richard for $80. In addition to, of course, the T-shirts, I love my KPFK T-shirts. Yes, plural. A couple different options, and as well as the tote bags. Tote bags, $50 pledge. You get that as a thank you gift. The T-shirts, I think, are $65.
What about your cups? I know you love the cups.
Yeah, I don't know. They may be. Oh, they're back. Oh my gosh. I just saw they are back. $65.
Make room in the kitchen cupboard.
Yes, KPFK logo mug. It's the Shepherd Fairy logo, which I love. It's the big, it looks like just bursting. It's a picture of a microphone, old school microphone. And Stephen Rohde is showing me on Zoom the trial of Socrates. Steve, go ahead and say.
I have Stone.
Yes, when I made my recent contribution, I chose I.F. Stone's historic work, The Trial of Socrates. If you want to talk about the suppression of diverse viewpoints, Socrates is one of the earliest cases, and I.F. Stone was such a brave, independent journalist. Yeah. I don't want to mislead anyone if this book is still on the list of items premiums for you.
That was how much was it, Steve? Do you remember how much that was?
This was $100.
All right. Yes.
So it's a great book by itself, and what a privilege to support the station and get a great read out of it. So I'm sure books like that, this one or others, are available.
Absolutely. Maria mentioned that before. And CDs, documentary CDs that you can use to help with your organizing or to help learn about a subject quickly. There's no better way to do it than a CD. And a number of those are available, too. But if you go to the website at kpfk.org, and you'll find all sorts of ways in which we say thank you. And they're all aimed at your enjoyment, whether if it's music, they're aimed at your education, if it's the documentary films, or they're aimed at just your needs of bags for when you go to the grocery store, cups to drink your coffee out of, and T-shirts to wear, and a hot summer day.
T-shirts to wear proudly, and then see other people with the same T-shirt, and you're like, hey, you're cool.
That's right. It is a family. We speak of the KPFK family, and that's really true. The music is telling us now it's time to go. So we thank you for listening to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. We'll be back with you next week as well.
Yes, make your pledge.
Make your pledge. Until then, Jim Lafferty and Maria Hall, thanks for listening today. And remember to stand up for your rights, my friends.
Stand up for your right. Get up.
If you don't already know about it, it's really time to discover KPFK. KPFK is community radio from Southern California, powered by people like yourself for over six decades now. It's part of the completely unique Pacifica Network, and our listeners and sponsors are passionate. We've routinely heard them say things like,
"It is the best source of news that I know of."
The main thing that distinguishes Pacifica from the rest of the media landscape is our funding model, listener sponsorship. It allows us to speak to what really matters in our listeners' lives. Consider becoming a part of this impassioned community by making a pledge today. With your generous